If you want to take part in the Christmas card stream, now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial X. This is the final stream for tonight, and I'm now here with a regular on Millennial. Let me just see how many times he's appeared.
I'm actually curious myself.
Yeah, let's see. If you go to the website and type in the name, you can find this out quite easily. This is your seventh time.
Wow. That's amazing. It's quite an institution, I'll say that. It's really amazing. Yeah, no, it's always really pleasant because you get a chance to see where everyone is at the end of the year and their thinking and where they expect to be, or, you know, how they expect the next few years to play out or the next year to play out. And I think this is a particularly interesting one because it seems that things have really radically changed in the last year from a political point of view, and no one is quite sure of where things are going to head from this point out.
All right. Well, I actually didn't introduce you. I started, but then I failed.
Go ahead. My bad.
No, it's my fault. So I'm now here with Based Dave, the Distributist, who is an American Tradcath Supremo, emergence regarder, and reactionary gadfly.
I was like, it's so funny because people call me trad, but in my own religious circle, trad refers to people who attend the Latin Mass, and I don't attend the Latin Mass. So I feel like I'm a poser, you know.
Right. You're a phony.
Yeah, exactly. I'm claiming more traditional, you know. I'm not as austere as I should be for that title, but anyway, it's always a pleasure to be here.
All right. Thank you. Well, so let's get into it then. Obviously, this year, you know, I put the question to Martin Lichtmes last night, and he had nothing to say about it. And I thought, I was surprised, because to me, it's an obvious point to make that 2024 has been an interesting year. I think you've got rather more to say about that than our Austrian friend did.
Well, it's strange because, you know, 2024 has been a long disaster for our ruling class, but it didn't start in 24, it started in 23 on October 7th. When October 7th happened, the ability of the media to control the narrative was declining and had been declining since the end of COVID. And it was searching around for some kind of alternative way it could frame things, specifically a way that it could keep its own activist energy going. Then October 7th happened, and what emerged was an intractable civil war on the left, which divided its activist class from its funding class. And the problem is that the left, or the center left, has never been able to really get back on an even keel. It's just been kind of teetering in its foundations, trying desperately to do one thing and then the other. And as such, everyone's kind of staring at the situations that have emerged and trying to figure out what politics is going to look like in the coming years. The coalitions aren't stable anymore. I think that's something that's very apparent from where I sit.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Could you describe what the coalitions were that were stable before, like, let's say, well, during COVID, and what's happened to them since then?
Okay, that's good. So COVID was probably the height of the left's ability to exert its narrative power. Now, it was not the height of the left's narrative power. The height of the left's narrative power probably was in the 90s, or sorry, whatever we call the center left, like Clintonian thing, right? In the 90s, you could not see outside of the Clintonian center left worldview. But at the same time, its footprint was very, very light. In 2020 and 2021, the footprint became very, very heavy because they were afraid of losing narrative control from the internet. And what emerged as sort of their ideal ruling coalition was a combination of sort of quite strangely, let's get the classic ones, which would just be the sort of center-left bureaucrats that run the government, the radical identity politics groups that were the product of universities and decades of university fads and education, and that basically have colonized the minds of a majority of millennials and Zoomers. And then a certain segment of the American and European middle classes, specifically the upper middle classes, and then choice industries, most importantly, all of the media industries, Silicon Valley. And in the intervening years since 2022 in particular, these coalitions have fallen into complete disarray. And I guess you could also group in the neocon establishment, which, you know, that's sort of the other half of the American deep state. Half of it is sort of Clintonian liberal. The other half is neocon in the security apparatus. And what happened very slowly over the course from 2022 onward is that as the Biden administration persisted, there are certain contradictions that cause a lot of people to kind of jump ship. Starting with Elon Musk, there's been a growing feeling in Silicon Valley that the Democrats no longer represent their interests, and that the wokeness actually, you know, I hate using that word, but whatever you want to call it, the DEI bureaucracy or the woke ideas coming out of the university actually don't correspond to the vision that they want for humanity, and that they're looking for something different. And I think that was kind of more or less a minor thing. That was more of a vibe shift than it was actually any real thing. All you had was a bunch of Silicon Valley bigwigs kind of counter-signaling woke, which is something that's happened many times in the past, especially in California. But then when October 7th hit, this is when the other foot dropped. All of a sudden, the two ends of the left completely declared war on each other. The part of the left that manages the universities suddenly saw their radical third worldist, they radically took off. I don't know how to put this because the universities aren't united either, right? But the radical identity politics that had ruled the universities hopped on to a more third worldist perspective that put them on the side of the Palestinians. And the rest of the administration and the rest of the deep state essentially sided with Israel, which is where all the money comes from in America, at least. This is where all the big donors, they're all pro-Israel, all of the lobbyist, I mean, not all of them, but the majority of the lobbyist organizations. I'm sure you've heard stories about, you know, the influence of
I have heard rumors.
They're very deeply embedded everywhere. And if you want, you know, if you go to a dinner party where people who are passing, who are approving grants, right, or that's how they get these NGOs get funding, right, it'll naturally be accompanied by most of the people who have a preference for Israel. And so now all of a sudden, this was not like a small disagreement. There have been these disagreements that have appeared in the past, but this has been a major narrative disagreement that has just torn the left apart. And suddenly it became apparent to a lot of the Democrats that they might be just as alienated from their radical fringe as they are from, say, the Republican Party. In fact, they are more like the neoconservatives. The Clintonites are more like the Bush guys than they are like either the far right or the far left. And this is sort of a problem for both sides, but it's a particular problem for the left because the left needs both of these sides to work in tandem. And people don't really, and that was one of the insanities of 2020, was you had sort of this managerial, overreaching deep state that that was deeply embedded in government and law enforcement to the point where they literally could hire people to spy on you and make sure that you stayed in your house. As late as 2021, that happened to me. I guess that was in Canada, but that's another story, right? But it, but there was that stuff. Then they were sponsoring radicals in buildings. These two elements were voting in the same direction. They're pushing in the same direction politically. That can't happen anymore. And now the ability, the left's ability to concoct narratives and just float them has been seriously diminished. I have a friend, Isaac Simpson, who says the left can't current thing an event anymore. It can't say this is going to be the current thing, because if ever there was a left, an event that the left wanted to not make the current thing, it would be Gaza. And that's been the current thing for, you know, the better part of a year now.
Would you say that that's because of Elon Musk taking over Twitter? Because I suspect that's a huge part of it. I think without that, I mean, I remember someone, I think it was Keith Woods, saying that if it weren't for X, everyone would now believe that the atrocities, like the Palestinians were baking babies and stuff like that. But as it was, nobody believed that because there'd been so much to counter it on X.
Maybe. I mean, I think, you know, this has happened before, and I'm speaking as someone who's spent way too much time in Berkeley, California. I've known that this has happened before, and certainly no one in Berkeley was thinking that the Israelis were the good guys in the last three times there have been battles over Gaza or Lebanon or even parts of Syria. But there was always kind of this weird narrative two-step the establishment did, where it could kind of use an appeal to safetyism to rein in the dissenters and then renormalize itself. Okay, those guys are just kind of kooky weirdos. That's just kind of a weird segment of Berkeley. We don't need to pay attention to them. But those radicals have gotten higher and higher in positions of power inside the deep state. So when they all go against Israel, that's not something that can be swept under the rug. They can't just say, oh, well, that's just Princeton, that's just Yale, that's just Berkeley. This is now people who are actually part of administrating the funding of these institutions. And so...
So hold on. Would you say that something like Claudine Gay, I would have thought was quite a big problem for this establishment, whereas you're saying that people like her have never been a big problem. It's the people who are in the deep state that are the problem.
Well, I mean, I would consider university administrators to be part of the deep state. They are functionally part of the government because they have a say on where the government's money goes, which is sort of, that's foundation. That's how all these NGOs get funded. I'm sure that the majority of Claudine Gay was the former president of Harvard that got caught plagiarizing. And what's funny is she didn't really even have a record as an academic, as you would assume. I would assume the majority of her time was spent deciding who got funding for various large grants that were given to Harvard. Mm. And I assume that in her job, which still pays the exact same amount of money, it still decides those things. But Claudine Gay's ideology was not that different from the State Department's ideology. And I don't exactly know what her opinion is on Gaza, but I do know that in the 90s, when these problems with Israel erupted, they were almost entirely in the student body. Now they're extensive across the university and to the point where institutions have a hard time functioning, which is a much bigger problem for them. I'd say, you know, Elon Musk, you mentioned him earlier. That's sort of the part that is, well, as I mentioned earlier, Elon Musk gradually made it possible for you to be a right-winger in Silicon Valley. And I don't exactly know how far this is going to go, but he was definitely enormous in breaking the sort of, you know, uniformity of opinion that used to exist in the tech center. And I don't think that makes them our guys. In fact, they're kind of like these weird transhumanists. But what is important is it makes them not the part of the establishment consensus anymore. As a matter of fact, the establishment doesn't even know what its consensus is. It's searching around for some other way to make things make sense, and it doesn't have a good answer for that at the moment.
Well, obviously, people in our sphere have speculated that that consensus that the establishment arrives at will be 80s Americana.
Like, oh yeah. Oh, that's what they want. Oh yeah. And that's huge. Like that's what the establishment deep state would love, what they're really, really hoping for is that they get all of the conservatives in America and Europe to recongeal around some kind of Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan neoconservatism with, I don't know, maybe the immigration rate toned down a few notches, and then reconsolidate the consensus around that, because that would allow them to kind of consolidate the gains they have made while at the same time convincing the rest of the crazies in the left that if you don't get back on message, we're going to cut off your funding. And I think that's the direction they want to go. And I think in the coming year,
what would be the obstacles to that consensus?
The obstacles is that it's totally unbelievable. you've seen these. This is something that we've talked a lot about, right? In the last year, are these characters like James Lindsay and Constantine Kissin, and even people who used to be part of the left, like Bill Maher, or now even Cenk Uygur, that's how you pronounce his name, right? These Turkish names never seem to roll off the tongue properly. But it's all these people who are just like, they're kind of consolidating.
It's definitely Cenk, but I'm not sure about the surname.
Cenk Uygur, right? Like, I
thought it was Uygur.
Uygur? Cenk Uygur. Perhaps that's...
Let's just call him Cenk.
Cenk. The Young Turks guy. And these people are all making signals that they want to come back to some kind of consolidated center. But the problem is it makes absolutely no sense. It only makes sense as sort of a political party of status quo stability. It makes no sense once you actually try to tell people what we believe. The question about exactly what transgenderism is would immediately come to the foreground. A question about what a nation is, a question about morality. I mean, these are questions that, didn't really have to be answered in a real way before things started falling apart, because during the 20th century, we just kind of pushed them under. And we made them part of sort of the background noise of society. Like, everyone knows what a nation is. American patriotism is just whatever it is. This is the American flag and Rambo and all this other stuff. But now that we're actually facing more existential crises about how our societies are even going to remain stable, these questions have to have an answer to them. And the thing is that Constantine Kissin's answers to what constitutes a nation and a people are just totally nonsensical. I mean, you interrogate them and they fall apart. I mean, the same thing for Wokal Distance, which, I mean, I want to differentiate Wokal Distance here as I think he's a sincere believer. But the ideology he promotes is like, it's this tenuous chain of ideas that never actually touch the grass of how humans actually operate. And you see it, I mean, most prominently you can see in people like Kissin. I think that the sort of emperor has no clothes moment came when, I don't know, do you remember this a few months ago when Kissin was on a documentary saying that there never had been a terrorist attack that was worse than October 7th. It's the worst terrorist attack in human history.
I didn't know he'd said that. I know he's said quite a few stupid things recently, but I didn't know he'd said that.
That's not the best part. The best part is how he figured it. He said, well, I know it killed. It killed only a fraction of the people that 9/11 killed. But the lives that were lost on October 7th were worth more, because there are fewer Jewish Israelis than there are Americans in the world. so you have to adjust with the denominator, And if you adjust as proportion of the number of Jewish Israelis there are in the world, therefore the lives lost are worth more. But let's steel man this for a second. I mean, that's actually not so ridiculous, right? Like, you know, you and I can see that and they can say, okay, look, you know, I understand if you viewed international politics as a set of races and peoples and tribes, you know, you can say that the Jewish race was damaged more by October 7th than the American race was damaged by September 11th, right? Like, you could say that collectively speaking. But Constantine Kissin doesn't believe in collectives. His entire career has been one about how it's the individual. So in the context of individualism, according to Constantine Kissin, he wants to be an individualist who says that the individual value of certain people is greater than the individual value of others. And nobody in their right mind is going to accept this cloud cuckoo land ideology. Like, nobody, everyone just collectively laughed their asses off at Constantine Kissin when he said that.
I remember when he put up on his Twitter years ago that he was proud to be. He'd won some award, like the Jewish Comedian of the Year Award, something like that, while he's preaching individualism for the rest of us. And of course, there's a blatant contradiction there, which I think is the same contradiction that you're talking about here, where, well, why are you proud of that? If it should mean nothing to you.
Yeah.
And yet it doesn't. So, and then again here, well, what difference does it make if there are, I've just checked, there are apparently 11 million Ashkenazi Jews in the world. Well, there are fewer Scots people. So is Scottish collectivism okay? No, it's not.
Or do you, when a Scottish person is killed by a terrorist, right? I think wasn't there a terrorist attack in Scotland in the last years?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, does that mean that it's adjusted upwards so that it's worth that many more Jewish lives? It was as if, like, you know, two or three times.
Can you imagine what would happen if I said, and this, I'm not making this statement, right, just for the benefit of the security services, but if I were hypothetically to say, a Scottish, because there are fewer Scots in the world than Ashkenazi Jews, a Scottish life is worth more than an Ashkenazi Jewish life. If I were to make that statement, I think that would be hate speech.
Yeah, but we have to be careful here because according to the laws, because the thing is, like, there is, if Bibi Netanyahu had said what Constantine Kissin had said, I wouldn't give him a shit, right? Because Bibi Netanyahu or Yoram Harzoni, he literally believes that, like, the human race is comprised of different peoples, and they all, like, they're, and peoples and races are like organic collective entities that have, like, interests that need to be protected, right? Maybe he doesn't say that, but that's what he actually believes. So if he said, you know, if he was adjusting proportionately to the population, then I would say that, like, that's a little bit weird, but fundamentally nothing that I can't respect. But when individualists make that kind of calculation, it makes absolutely no sense. And it belies the fact that they don't actually believe in individualism. And you see this everywhere. I mean, the thing is that there have been a number of things that have happened over the course of the last few years that have shown that people don't really believe in individualism the way that we were all supposed to believe it in the 1990s. I mean, if nothing else, half the things that happened during COVID demonstrated that. And so now everybody is sort of dancing around this fact. They're trying to pretend like they believe something that used to be a thing. And I think in the case of people like Vocal Distance, he actually does believe in individualism. But the problem is that belief in individualism does not address any of the relevant problems in our world today. Are the problems that exist in our world today cannot be put in individual terms. And if they are, they somehow miss a large part of the real crisis we are experiencing.
Yeah, the world is made out of groups. That's just the reality. Obviously, everyone is an individual. I don't think anyone... who the hell would ever deny that? Of course, we're all individuals. But groups are also a real thing. Mm-hmm. And again, how silly do you have to be to deny that? Of course, groups like there is such a thing as the Swedish people. There are such individuals who belong to the Dutch people that they're off that group. So what's the problem? I mean, why would you ever deny this? Unless you had nefarious goals, frankly. Unless you're an idealist, let's put it that way, because there are white people who believe this, like autistic libertarians who believe this. But I think they're just deluded.
Yeah, I think what they're worried about is they're trying to think, okay, how are we going to make our society work in the current crisis that it's gotten itself into? And the best thing that they can come up with is some form of 90s liberalism. Now, the fact that it doesn't make any sense matters less than the fact that it would be really, really convenient if it did make sense. So there's this kind of like wishful thing, right? Wouldn't it be great? So let's just pretend that this thing still works the way it once did and then proceed accordingly. I don't know. No one's really buying this anymore.
I think we're beyond it. We've had too much of identity politics for other groups to now believe this. I think that's really the crux of it.
And identity politics works, right? I mean, it got everything that these groups now have as minorities in the West, or a large portion of the benefits and privileges that they have, would never have been given to them had they not claimed special victimhood status. Nor will they be taken away by the people who are like Konstantin Kissin and saying that we need to be all the individual. So the idea that you're going to reestablish that idea, you just want to deracinate everyone to the point where no one can.
Oh, you're roboting quite a lot, Dave.
Here.
Yes.
Okay.
Unintelligible. Yeah, yeah. I don't know why. What causes that.
Okay, maybe it's I think my connection's good.
Oh, mind you, if that happens again, I will unmute my microphone because I think that actually, for some reason, has an effect. So, sorry, could you just repeat what you were saying?
Oh, no, I think part of the hope is that they just deracinate everyone so that there cannot be any collective identities of any variety. The problem is, I think that deracinated people don't reproduce themselves. And so that even if you deracinate a population, through Darwinian selection, there will be an ethnogenesis that comes out that will be comprised of the people who actually have children and who care about the future beyond themselves.
Yeah. I think that to motivate, see, it's almost like reproduction is not entirely selfish. Obviously everyone enjoys sex. And I think there is a certain desire to have an heir, and obviously to have children and the family life and all that. But there's also a motivation which is dependent on belonging to a group, because you're thinking about the future of your group. And I think a lot of people would, like in Britain, would see that in terms of my town. I want my town to continue. I want it to be pretty much the same as it has been when I have known it. I want my country to continue. Or they might see it in explicitly racial terms, but either way, there's a sense of contributing towards a continuity. And that is a reason why, and I'm not saying it's the reason why anyone has children, but I think it's definitely a motivating factor.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is there's no way around the concept of peoplehood, which is, you know, it doesn't really conform necessarily to kind of like the autistic understanding of race that comes out of the 19th century. But it mostly because it's smaller, right? But the idea of a people, like a genetic posterity going from the past to the future and unified by a tradition of constant moral principles, that's what motivates most people throughout history. It's a core part of even biblical teachings. Like, you can't understand the Bible without a concept of peoplehood. That's core. And so the idea that we're going to, you know, because of the 20th century, we're going to dispense with this notion and we're going to come out with a new liberal man. That's what's essentially being demanded. And as everyone can see quite plainly, the new liberal man doesn't work.
Yeah.
He's politically weak. he's a consumer. He's a bug man. That's a proper label for him. He has no past, and because the new liberal man has no past, people who have no past have no future. It's that simple. He will not continue on his ideas. He will not continue on his genetics. He will not continue on his civilization. And Darwinian,
I think that's a really good way to say it. People who have no past have no future. That's what I was getting at earlier. That
people, it works both ways. The people who have no past will have no future, but the person who has no understanding of his past will not think for the future, nor care about how his actions feed forward into the future.
Yeah.
Beyond his own vanity, of course. That's how you get destiny, right? Destiny is he is the ideal liberal man in many ways.
Yeah. You see, you're very ensconced in YouTube still.
You blessed souls who have not heard of the travails of destiny in 2024 can truly be considered more spiritually elevated than myself. But they have been really funny woes. You have to give me that.
The thing is, I was going to say, I don't like it when people's private lives are delved into and all that, because it is horrible. It's happened to me.
Yeah.
It's horrible. But at the same time, he seems to enjoy it. I think he was proud of it when that blowjob video got released. I think he was happy.
I didn't even think of that. I was just thinking of the whole whole polyamory thing earlier in the year. But yeah,
and that, and yeah, he was paying the guy to, yeah, whatever. I mean, it's just, the thing is, these decisions do seem significant, and they speak of a nature that is a product of our time, and it's hideous.
Yeah, it's hideous, and it just doesn't work too, and that's what. Sort of I don't know. It sounds like I'm talking to you from 2017 if I say the cathedral, but I literally just mean the media and the establishment elite consensus. But the establishment elite consensus realized that when they built their coalition, that several pillars are really unstable. And, you know, you can't really have a ruling coalition that's built on, forgive me for saying this, you can't really have a ruling coalition that leans so heavily on the emotions of hysterical women. It's not reliable. And that's what a lot of the Democrats realized, the Democrats and really the elite parties everywhere have been realizing, that their coalition is incredibly unstable. That unless they completely manage the information flow, it immediately breaks up. And then half of the people that they consider their stalwart soldiers will immediately break away the second the vibes don't match up.
Yeah, it is a very interesting problem that I don't know if we had recognized this time last year. I think we did. We knew that October the 7th was going to have shockwaves. It was going to mess. It had. It had already messed things up. But now what we're seeing this year and what we're talking about is the longer term manifestations of that, which are very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's unclear how people are going to put everything together. I mean, this creates kind of a crisis for the right, because right now the establishment is toying with coming clean about some of these things that it's been lying about, right? It's, you know, I mean, it already came clean about the transmissibility of COVID after vaccination. I guess that was kind of a gimme. It's trying in Europe to come clean about the effectiveness of pediatric gender care. A lot of European countries have bit the bullet on that. But and it even kind of toys, and you see this every now and again, it even kind of toys with like, well, maybe we could admit that certain elements of what were once called human biodiversity are actually true. I've seen professors and I've seen establishment journalists toy with this idea. Now the question is, what does this actually mean? Because they've done this numerous times before. And the problem is they've realized that there's no way that they can say that out loud, endorse that, and have a stable coalition afterwards. But at this point, they're willing to say and do anything to get a stable coalition, a stable ruling class back in charge. And the question is, to what degree can we use that by essentially playing into the concession? And how much can we use that by playing in opposition to the concession, right? To becoming more radical. Because it's a fake concession. They want to get this concession in place so that they can get permission to rule again.
Yeah. Of course, it's to stabilize their to secure their position, really. So what? I mean, I want to get this clear. Are you saying that, as I summarized earlier, there has been too much identity politics to now pretend that that didn't happen, to roll back on that and just return to the 90s? Is that,
well, I mean,
a decent summary, or is there more to it than that?
I mean, I guess that's the open question, right? I mean, the establishment, the ruling class of the Democrat Party and the moderate Republicans and like the Bill Maher's of the world, they all want to row back on the identity politics canoe. The question is, can they? I think that it's fairly obvious from our point of view that it is absolutely imperative that they don't put the genie back in the bottle on this one. Mainly because what will happen is that under the table identity politics for our enemies will persist as usual. Now, so I think that the project of the next year by the mainstream will be to attempt to put, as my friend Academic Agent says, they will attempt to put the woke away. I believe that this attempt will be unsuccessful, but they will certainly try this because it's their only move right now.
So let's get to that then. The woke, that encompasses not just identity politics, but ideas about society, social justice, maybe a bit of communism, but sort of lightweight, augmented communism. And a sense that society owes these various groups various things, reparations and so on.
Yeah.
And a sense that the norms of the past were awful and should be done away with. So that's, let's say, that's wokery. That has been, I think, very damaging to society. It's been very damaging to individuals, as we were actually, my previous interview attested. Mm-hmm. It's been very damaging to groups. And it's actually been damaging to the military in America.
Yeah, strangely.
And the economy. It's been damaging to everything. But I think the idea was that doesn't matter because, well, we're in the business of destroying Western civilization. That seemed to be a fairly conscious goal on the part of what would you say about that? Or do you think that
I'm not 100% sure it's conscious. Their business model does operate by disintegrating civilization, but I think they see this as them expanding their power. The civilizational disintegration is a byproduct, right? As you would have to necessarily pollute the air to burn coal, they have to necessarily burn civilization to get the energy they need. But this process appears to be at a point where they can't push it any further. And I guess that's how I would see the issue.
So yeah, it's become more trouble than it's worth at this point. And I think we've seen that in various ways, but especially that the public just aren't buying into it. It's for many different reasons. I don't think they really believe that a woman can become a man or vice versa. I think they don't believe that there's some sort of mystery as to what a woman is. I think everyone knows what a woman is. I think they're sick of the gay propaganda, and they're sick of the, it's always a black guy with a white woman in adverts. White men are always made to look stupid in commercials, in film, and so on.
Man, that's really scaled back though this Christmas, hasn't it?
I don't know. I haven't actually had time to watch any of these awful Christmas adverts that come out every year.
Academic Agent review them every year. But
yeah,
I bet you any amount of money that they'll be significantly less woke this year. I would really put a lot of money on that.
Yeah, Academic Agent did a summary. I've forgotten who it was with, but the problem is that it's 3 hours long, and I don't have during Millennial. I don't have time to watch it, but I will watch it after this is all over.
I first noticed it. You know where I first noticed this pullback was at the Super Bowl last year, I guess it's still this year, right? But the Super Bowl that was after October 7th. I'm like, what happened to all of the interracial couples that were in every single ad? I think you actually saw a white family. It was amazing.
It's incredible that we describe that as amazing.
No, but you could feel. I mean, it was bland slop, to be sure. I mean, it was actually, in some sense, the commercials were more boring. They were more deracinated because now you're getting, they've gone back to how, or a little more, they've gone back to how they were in the 90s. But in the 90s, you kind of believed that, right? I don't know. Do you remember the 90s? Didn't you kind of believe that your consumer choices had like deep significance to them?
yeah.
And now you look at that and you think, holy shit, no, I don't, right? This whole idea that I'd go and get a product at Best Buy and I'd be so enthusiastic about it. It's not only not my experience, it's utterly anathema to everything that I feel about my relationship to consumer products and to technology and to society.
That is an interesting point in itself, that this relationship between consumers and products seems to have been ruptured by the wokery, apart from anything else. I think they've wanted us to be such consumers that they've offered us nothing, that we've been allowed nothing else. But somehow the result of that has been a disconnection, so that people can't identify. As you said, with that Apple commercial that was on, the guy's got the hearing aid to help. I think that's the gist of it, that he's deaf and his daughter is playing musical instruments and he's got this Apple
hearing aid
that enables him to hear her.
That's like, wholesome. Yeah,
it's wholesome, and yet I don't buy into it. It's almost like they've just forgotten how to even appear sincere.
Well, I mean, the thing is they forgot that, you know, the whole problem of the modern world, when I look forward into the future, I don't think like, oh, well, my daughter, you know, I don't have a daughter, I have a son, but I don't think, well, of course, my daughter is going to be a classical musician. And I'm really concerned that when I'm 80, I won't be able to hear her performance to be a Juilliard classical musician, which of course will be popular then. Our society has said that it does not care whether people like me reproduce. It certainly does not care about trying to transmit to them certain elements of classic 18th century white supremacist culture, like classical music. Mm. And it does everything in its power to tear away women in particular from deeply valuing the same cultural touchstones as their grandparents.
And it despises the nuclear family as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, at the end of all of this, I mean, the scene is very affecting, but the point that feels particularly threatened are not whether technology can overcome this element of human frailty, but whether our leaders want to completely capsize any vision into the future that looks remotely like this.
What a situation.
No, but yeah. I mean, it's serious because, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, you know, the problem that the Lindsays and the Kissens have in all of this is they want to go back to wholesomeness. But the second they center these questions of peoplehood and family, this naturally triggers follow-up questions. Like, okay, well, in the past, our country has had a common culture, which the government has been invested in ensuring the continuation of. Why can't it do that anymore? And the problem is that when you start asking these questions about what happened to make this not something that could be pursued anymore, you start ending up with answers that are not very flattering for the side that people like Bill Maher and Constantine Kissin represent. Minimally, they make you question your ideas about individualism and a morally neutral state. But then, I mean, you can go down sort of darker paths where you start asking questions about the political affiliations and maybe ethnic affiliations of the particular bad actors that brought these events into pass. And those, you know, that's sort of a line of questioning that the ruling class does not want us to go down at all.
Well, definitely. But I was just thinking there, that's an Apple commercial and it's this wholesome family and all that. But I think less than a year ago, there was an Apple commercial with, what's his name, Tim Cook, and Mother Earth or Mother Nature, and she was portrayed as the huge black mama.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, well, okay, so, I mean, I know it's not directly contradictory. There's always been, you know, I can remember in the 80s, you'd have the big black mama and so on, back in Gone with the Wind. Oh, yeah, sure, it's there, but that wasn't the tenor of that advert a year ago. The tenor there was that basically black people are wiser than us. And black women, especially.
Yeah.
You know, black women's listening. So, sorry, a black woman's talking, so we should all shut up and listen.
Yeah, and it's as if, it's kind of weird because, first of all, you know, we could analyze this. That I know the exact commercial you're talking about, and we could analyze it till the cows come home, but I guarantee you that we're putting more brain cells into it than the writers who wrote it, because you can just see that I can visualize the room in Palo Alto where that commercial was written up, and the room is occupied by 10 people. 9 of them are female. Maybe one of them is male and one of them is indeterminate gender. And then like 8 of the females are like Asian. and they're sitting there and they think it would be a great idea if the CEO had to have our experience of doing performance reviews, because of course, what do all, I mean, in particular, women hate the performance review of all time. You know, they hate performance reviews more than men do because it's confrontation, right? So what if we made our boss do the thing that we hate doing the most? And what's the most satisfying, cathartic thing for him to answer to? Well, of course, the black woman, right? Like that's how that commercial got written, right? Like that was the exact thought process. I guarantee it. It's let's make our boss go through the most stressful part of our work here that we have to. And we want him to answer to the icon of our ideology, which is of course an overweight black woman. And so that's how, I mean, so, you know, we can analyze this, but I guarantee you it was just that emotional kind of like very female instinct of revenge against the boss that motivated that. Nothing deeper. No one was consulting bell hooks for that commercial. but it is, you know, it is interesting. Like, you know, the image that it creates, and there was actually a better one in British television where it was like some Tudor queen of England who was black and all of her chefs were white, and they're pleading for mercy as they brought her all of these delicatessens to eat.
I remember that. Yeah, like, I think that was last Christmas.
I think that was either last Christmas or 2 years ago. Well, I think it might have been 2 years ago. I think it was before October 7th, so that would have been 2 years ago, right? But it was all of the expertise of this European kingdom was put to the effort of feeding more food to this overweight black woman. I mean, it couldn't be more perfect if you had created it as part of right wing propaganda. But I don't know. I mean, I guess we have to be careful because our enemies are not thinking as deeply about this as we are. I'm convinced that this is just some lazy phoned in art project well, in the case of Apple, it's a lazy phone-in art project from a bunch of Berkeley and Stanford graduates. I don't know who's what's the equivalent in England? Cambridge?
Well, I don't know. That's an interesting question.
There's probably some art school in England.
Yeah, probably the one I went to be honest, now that I think of it.
But, I mean, no, the thing is that... In previous iterations of this cycle, what the left does is just forgets that it was ever radical. But it's really hard to forget that you said things in this day and age because of social media. because people can pull up what you said in the past.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's still there on YouTube. It's right there. You know, this is just as it was when you released it 2 years ago or whatever, or 5 years ago or 10 years ago. As I've been saying before with other guests, in this day and age, nothing gets forgotten. So it's instantly recallable.
Which actually works to our advantage, right?
It does when they're trying to run away from their own statements, yeah.
I mean, ideally, this is sort of my hope, is that I don't know how this conversation is working in the UK. But in the US, the real interesting things happening right now are in the Republican Party. Specifically, and this is why Aaron McIntyre is always such an interesting person, is because Aaron McIntyre, unlike myself, comes from a red state, like, you know, a Baptist community. But, you know, we would know the Baptists, the modern Baptist now is kind of reconceived as evangelical, right? As all more or less Orthodox traditions kind of became in the 90s, it seemed. But he has his finger on the pulse of this conflict that's going on inside conservatives and Christian communities in America that's trying to grapple with this understanding of collective identity and collective responsibility. And it really is a generational battle, I'll say that. And it's unfortunate that the older generations have their hands just so firmly on the wheel that even though they just get humiliated again and again and again in these online interactions, they still kind of maintain their position at the front of the line. And I can think of the conflicts that I've had with Joel Berry, the guy from the Babylon Bee.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he Joel Berry, again, he's a Zionist, right? So he's against identity politics, except Zionism, which is identity politics. But he knows enough to understand that we have a point, but he doesn't want to engage with it directly. He wants to counter signal it and hope that I pretty much guarantee that his funders will hear our ideas and they'll understand that we have a point, but it'll feel scary to them because they know that to essentially endorse our ideas is to endorse a massive societal upheaval that will necessarily have to take place. Because once you tug on the idea of being responsible, not to just a collection of individuals, but a group of peoples, even if you consider that, as I believe, that the United States has a responsibility to many different peoples, right? That like the UK, this is an alliance of peoples, just as the British Crown has an obligation to Scots and English. And I think that the American Republic has a responsibility to African Americans and Native Americans and Anglos, right? But once you adopt that frame, the whole motivating logic for so much of our society just starts coming unraveled. We start thinking about generational wealth and how things will be for our children and our grandchildren and how we can keep that continuity going. And then we have to rethink the dating market. We have to rethink pornography. We have to rethink sexual liberty. We have to rethink mass migration. And we have to rethink freedom of association. I think that there's progress made there. I see for the first time, for instance, that a lot of American Christians are beginning to question the Civil Rights Act, which is, you know, it's a core part of anti-liberal legislation in America. And to question that even 10 years ago would have been anathema. But now I feel like I see it fairly regularly.
Would you say that there was obviously a consensus, not just after the war, but after the 60s, that post-60s consensus, would you say that it's starting to fall apart, or is that too ambitious?
Yeah, I mean, it's starting to fall apart. It's starting to fall apart because it's being tugged from both ends. You know, and this is what sort of the James Lindsays of the world really are having a problem with, is that, and on civil rights too, it's a great example of this. Civil rights, it's really kind of, if you study the history of it, it's really amazing how dishonest it was, because a different version of civil rights was sold to white America than was sold to black America. civil rights was sold to white America as this is the way that we fulfill the promises of the founding fathers by essentially extending the provisions of our highly rewritten constitution to African Americans. And for a very limited time, we're going to have to temporarily suspend certain liberties and certain restrictions, say against racial preferences, so that we give them time to catch up and have equal opportunity. But to the African American community, what they sold it as was, this is the way that the African American community gets an equal share of the economic pie that is America. Because at the time this was being implemented, the Black community was being destroyed by drugs and fatherlessness in the early 60s.
And was that because of the fall of Christianity in that community?
Yeah, largely. And the thing is that, I mean, this is, if you remember the Mad Men era, you know, with the advent of the birth control pill, the American elite class basically more or less discarded the regulative norms of Christian sexual ethics. And this very quickly trickled down to the lower classes, in which case none of the insulation was there and all of the social regulation just kind of fell apart.
Yeah, that's a good example of something being doable for the upper classes.
This is also true too
for the working classes.
Yeah, and there is also sort of a built-in in the 30s, and I don't know how sustainable this would have been in modernity, but in the 30s during the Harlem Renaissance, the idea of Black economic empowerment was that they would have a totally separate economy, and this would be kind of like a functional job creation program. And a lot of Black leaders just wanted more money put into that entirely separate machine. And after the war, this sort of completely separate Black community started completely falling apart. And the neighborhoods that had been more or less thriving in decades previous, or relatively speaking, became just completely, completely economically destitute. And the idea was that the opportunities that civil rights opened up for the elite African Americans would compensate for the opportunities lost for working class African Americans. And, I think that there's been kind of an alliance of sides in this question that, you know, there's a whole class of Black professionals that would not have their jobs if not for DEI, and who would be properly, whose efforts would be properly spent ensuring that their own communities were well governed. You know, that there are genuinely smart African Americans at places like Google and Princeton. And I don't know how smart Claudine Gay is. She probably isn't as smart as your average president of Harvard, but she's definitely smarter than your average person. Her abilities would be much better placed making sure that an African American community was well governed and peaceful than it would be sort of funneling more money down various programs and apparently plagiarizing at Harvard. And you know that I really lament that, because they, you know, I think the African American community would listen to people like Claudine Gay, or maybe her husband. But
this is a good example of how. Sorry to interrupt.
No problem. Yeah,
this is a good example of how the civil rights era and all of that has created a sort of a new industry of race resentment and whatever DEI that doesn't help the client groups. It keeps them very much, well, it keeps them as client groups, so
yeah,
they're not actually helping their own people. It's rather they're helping the DEI industry.
Yeah, I mean, in America, for instance, Black Lives Matter, like we now pretty much know, and I don't exactly know how close the mainstream is to conceding this, but the data is there, you can just look at it. Like Black Lives Matter, the George Floyd movement, it kicked off an elevated murder rate that lasted for at least 2 or 3 years, from 2020 to 2023, which might be going down now. If you collect all of the people who died in that murder spree, it's like 2,000 or 3,000 African Americans. So Black Lives Matter killed 2,000 or 3,000 Black Americans in the name of their lives mattering. Because of the lackadaisical approach to prosecuting violent offenders in Black communities because of the fact that they just had no bail. People got out as soon as they got in. The fact that the cops didn't do discretional policing in these communities. It's 100% managerial, but it's 100% observable in the numbers. And that elevated murder rate killed a ton of Black people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as we said, it's something that was never really supposed to help the client group. It was supposed to change society and feed that industry and keep it going.
But the thing is that white America still believes in this individualized notion of civil rights. And that's what you see being defended by people like James Lindsay. But it's totally defunct. No one cares about that. Who cares about equality of opportunity? I've never met a single person other than Republicans who have cared about equality of opportunity.
No, they care about, yeah, indeed. Republicans care about that because they're desperate not to be racist. But liberals care about equality of outcome because they know that if it's just equality of opportunity, at some level they're realistic enough and racist enough to know that there will be divergent outcomes because groups are inherently different.
Oops, I muted myself there. And this is the African-American community also cares about good outcomes. I mean, I won't say even equality of outcomes. They want better outcomes for their people. That's what people actually want. And equality of opportunity, it's this unmeasurable chimera. It's this unmeasurable chimera. It doesn't make any sense. No one can say whether we've achieved it or not. And it's kind of right now, it's just kind of like this shibboleth that normie Republicans trot out occasionally to try to get people back on the reservation of believing in the dream. But nothing like that is actually deliverable or would solve any of our problems. And I think slowly, the younger conservatives are saying this, the younger Christian leaders are saying this. I don't know how successful we are going to be at grabbing the power back from the people who currently manage it, though.
Well, so this is about the post-60s consensus falling apart. And are there any other aspects of that? Like, for example, let's just say a random example, gay rights.
Yeah.
Do you think that is waning? Do you think people are turning? I mean, I'm sure they're sick of it, but do you think, because how could you not be at this point? But do you think that people are turning against it in any way?
I mean, I've said from the beginning that you get these like ridiculous things. I mean, I don't know if you pay attention to normie right-wing Twitter or normie right-wing YouTube, but they'll do cringe things like, LGB without the T. LBG, but not the T. It doesn't even sound like it is coherent in itself. It doesn't even, you can literally feel them trying to stop the ball in mid-swing. I mean, the question right now, and I think this is all of one cloth, all of one whole cloth, is what is the nature of sexual liberty? And the answer has to be necessarily you do not have sexual liberty. You do not have the right to do whatever you want with your sexuality because that directly pertains to how a society carries forth in the new generations. And I think this is going to fall apart. Already you see this falling apart a little bit because people they're balking from the transgender stuff. And then they're asking themselves, well, how different is this than gay marriage? And the answer is it's actually not any different. Because what gay marriage was actually about, again, to kind of revisit it like we did civil rights, what gay marriage was actually about was, can we redefine a term so that it is opposed to the original motivation of the institution in the name of equality? And if you can do that with the definition of marriage, then why can't you do that with the definition of woman? And if you reject that, then that kind of creates a cascading set of questions. But why did we have to go in for gay marriage, considering all of the destruction that gay marriage has caused? I mean, this is sort of one of the big owns that I remember from this last year was the whole monkeypox thing.
Oh, yeah.
And what you don't aware of is, maybe if you don't read the same shit libs that I do, You had the Andreas Olivan, you know, oh, this is a big crisis. We have to have immediate attention to this. He's this gay British conservative who used to write for the Atlantic Monthly. And then one of my favorite dissident writers, Steve Saylor, piped up with the infamous golf course icon and said, well, Andrew, don't you remember saying in the 1990s that had gays had marriage, the AIDS epidemic would never have happened? and he literally linked him to saying that. And then, you know, Andrew can't say anything. That is okay. Well, and the answer to that is that gay marriage did more to change straight behaviors by normalizing homosexuality than it did to actually change gay behaviors. And that was a fundamental. Once you understand that about gay marriage, what happened really was that gay marriage was legalized and then homosexuality became normalized. But what this also meant was that homosexual attitudes got normalized. And the way you really see the impact of this on the straight community is Tinder. Now, Tinder was an extension of an app called Grindr, which was for gay men to hook up. But it essentially took gay male culture and marketed it to straight women. And the results of Tinder have been an absolute disaster for the dating and mating market in the straight community, to the point where you can noticeably see a decline in marriages and birth rates that happen when that perspective is put into play. Because straight men and straight women cannot meet in one common market with speed being the predominant thing that's optimized for. That can absolutely not occur. The straight relationships, well, real relationships, and I'll let the listener infer what is implied by this, but real relationships do not work this way. So Tinder not managing, or Grindr not managing non-imaginary relationships was fine. But when this element of gay culture gets superimposed into heterosexual culture, like real relationships, it immediately causes huge disasters. In the same way that diseases hop from the gay community to the straight community.
Well, that's a very interesting perspective. Some people are saying that, hold on a second, this is nonsense. Legalizing gay marriage emboldened gay men to go full drag queen story hour.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think that's true as well. I mean, it clearly paved the way for the tranny stuff of the mid and late 2010s.
Well, it was a question of funding too, right? Because these organizations had accrued a huge number of contributions, and they needed to find, in the wake of that, something that could consume a similar number of activist resources. And the next logical one was transgenderism. And the next logical one after that was going to be polyamory. That they were kind of gearing up for that in 2023, but it fell flat a little bit.
Destiny got on board.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, I mean, Paul, I love polyamory because it just shows you how stupid you have to be to believe in it, because it's something that obviously does not work logically if you understand how men and women think. Oh, and yeah. There's no history of it working well either.
Oh no, a history of it working disastrously. It messes up communities.
Exactly. And so you see how you can, my favorite thing about this period, or at least debate wise, was watching Destiny argue for polyamory and winning by his own standards. Like, you can't prove to me, like, show me the study that shows that this obviously bad idea is a bad idea.
Yeah.
Show me four studies, show me five studies. In the meantime, everybody can see that it's a bad idea just by thinking logically a few steps forward into the future. And but you can trick yourself into believing that, right?
This is the whole problem. Leftist ideas are, you know immediately that they're bad. Like some particular idea, you know immediately that it's bad, but you can't describe it. It would take ages to scientifically prove that it's bad. So then the leftist says, well, obviously it must be good then. And you know that he knows that you're right. This is what's so infuriating about someone like Destiny, that you know that he knows you're right, but he's won the debate with dishonesty and whatever, shifting the goalposts, denying impossible amounts of evidence. I mean, if you did come up with five studies, he would ask, what was the sample size for each
one? And people love it. And people love the performance. I have to say, I really hate Destiny for that reason. He killed a discourse online for a generation. No one trusts it anymore. No one trusts conversations. And conversations do have a purpose. Like, debates do have a purpose. But the purpose is not to win. The purpose is to see how people emotionally react to the ideas in question. You know, I think you might have watched this, but I did every year, time around this time of year, I seem like I go on Benjamin Boyce's channel to have...
I have sat through your discussion with Vocal Distance.
But I actually like the guy, right? I actually like him. I find him, he's autistic, but like I respect anyone who's sincere, and he's sincere. But it's valuable not because like there's a certain quality to my argument or his argument, but it's just to see how the ideas are asserted in a space and how they're experienced by the people who are using them. And I think that's sort of the use of a debate. And it's to sort of get a feeling for the animal spirits involved. And that sounds very hand wavy or very Keynesian, so to speak, but it is true. It is a dimension of pathos to it. And when I think about what the purpose was in the early era of YouTube, it's that it was very, very easy to say that the people on the right and the people, even what we call back then the alt-right, that even if they had flaws in their perspective, they were speaking from a genuine, sincere concern. And for the most part, their opponents were speaking in the mode of ideology and in the mode of taboo. And I think that was an important learning that came out of that period. Yeah. And I think similar learnings could be seen. I mean, it's harder to tell on Twitter, right? But it's very obvious to me, for instance, that Joel Barry is just trolling us. Like he knows what the answer to these questions, these like he'll pose some gotcha, but he'll know what our response to it will be.
So he's just engagement farming then.
I guess.
Well,
I
don't and exactly know. Trying to protect his investors.
Yeah. I mean, his business. I mean, let's be fair to him. He's a business owner, and his business model does not work. If Joel Barry were to adopt the perspective of Orrin McIntyre in the Babylon Bee, which you know he could kind of do from a joke point of view, but his business model to who he sells to would suddenly start to disintegrate. And so it's important for him to have this moderate place to comfortably stay for his business model to keep on working. And so I kind of sympathize with him from a business point of view. But the problem is that the good of our country, of our species, in fact, depends on essentially excluding this comfortable illusion. We have to start thinking in terms of collectives and in terms of the long term. And in terms of social systems being sustainable or not. And if we can't speak in those terms and think in those terms, I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of evil that gets done in the next 10 years.
See, just to clarify, I wasn't going to insult Vocal Distance, right? Because I learned that mistake when I was interviewing Benjamin Boyce, and I inadvertently insulted someone who... turned out to be his friend. So I wasn't going to do that. I was just going to say, yes, that was for me anyway, it was a difficult debate to get through because I just couldn't stand what struck me as sophistry from Vocal Distance.
You see, Vocal's approaching this like a math problem, right? He's saying like, I need this thing to be true in order for society not to go through a huge unpleasant change, which is going to be a necessary change, right? And he's trying everything in his power to prop up this fixture, but he's trying to like sustain this like huge column with like spaghetti strings, and you know it's sincere, but it's important to understand that like this is not going to stand at any length of time, and that has to be, I think, respected. I guess. You know, this is generational in some sense. And I think that, you know, you see this in people like, you see very slowly older guys kind of coming around to this point of view, people like Nate Fisher, these people who are sort of patriarchs and well-to-do themselves, coming around and seeing this new perspective as sort of the reigning opinion of the day. But the problem is that I feel like this process needs to happen faster. Because I feel that the system starts, our ability to fix these things with a small amount of pain decreases as time goes on.
Yeah, certainly. There was something else that you said before I last interjected, something that, but I've forgotten what it was now, and I was going to pick up on it.
What was the rough?
Damn it. See, this is why I should take notes. Well, it was about Joel Berry and his perspective being unsustainable at this point.
I mean, Joel Berry.
See, there are really three people here. I mean, you could probably name others, but I can think of James Lindsay, Joel Berry, and Constantine Kissin, and these three guys.
And like half of the evangelical leadership online too. They're all in this point of view.
Right. They're trying to maintain something. I mean, it's like they don't want to be homophobic, but they've got to be pro that, but they've also got to be pro family because they've realized that all of this is unsustainable. Same with the trans stuff. I mean, they're in a very difficult position where they're trying to marry the 2010s with the 90s, basically.
Yeah.
I don't think you can.
Yeah, you can't because, like I said, like all of the concerns in the 2010s are essentially collective concerns, and the choice that optimizes benefit for the individual really obviously does not optimally benefit the well-being of the collective. And everybody right now, like every parent of children right now, is thinking, "What are my children going to do? What are my grandchildren going to do? How are we going to live in the future? Who's going to fight for us?" They're not thinking like, "Oh, well, you know, how can I get another payment for my car or something like that?" I mean, I guess some people are, right? But that's not a serious political consideration.
See, that's what I was going to pick up on. It was about this. It was about the collectives and the need for collectives. And what I was going to say was, I'll tell you an anecdote. There was a woman I knew, a boomer woman, really lovely, lovely woman. I loved her very much. And she said to me several times, she was a school teacher, and she said that kids from large families, like three, four, five children, were very well adjusted. Compared to, like, more, they were better adjusted generally than kids from two, like if they just had one sibling.
Yeah.
And certainly than if they didn't have any siblings.
That's hard. I only have one kid. So I gotta work on that.
Yeah. Yeah. You gotta get distributing. Well, anyway, the point is that she would also say that it's ridiculous to have three or four or five kids.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And I remember saying to her once, "Well, look, don't you think it's a good idea to have big families? Because as you've said, they're better adjusted. And also it's just better for society if people have more kids." And she interrupted. I remember she got really irate. And I've seen this with another boomer as well, where they got really irate. I was talking about abortion, and this guy got really irate. And it was the same with this woman. She got really irate, and she said, "I think people should have as many or as few kids as they want, as they want." And it was very much this emphasis, as with the guy with abortion, very much this emphasis on sexual liberty, personal choice, the rights of the individual above all else. And I think that really was a boomer. A sort of keystone, absolutely critical thing for them was the right of the individual to be free and to do what he wanted. And the thing is, that even sounds unrealistic. We clearly can't run society on that basis. There have to be norms, and those norms have to be, because people want guidance anyway, but there also have to be norms in order to keep things okay.
I mean, the thing is that your constraints define the individual just more, I would say, actually more so than your choices. You know, like people say, oh, did you choose to be born? No, right? But that's the most important thing that ever happened to you. And the other question is, well, do you have the right to kill yourself as a healthy individual in society via drugs or via Canadian healthcare? You know, this is classically something that almost everyone answers no, but modern society answers yes. The boomers, you know, during their experiences in the 60s, you know, there was a post-war vision of everywhere in the world becoming like the United States or like Britain. And this was sort of, in the 60s and 70s, you could see that this wasn't going to happen, that this would be sort of a process of third worldization. And there was a contradiction that was faced in the 60s. And the way that the boomers in particular reconciled this contradiction of vision to themselves was to say that it would all just be about individual choice. And that essentially stopped them from having to deal with the broader contradictions of the competing moral visions. You know, well, and maybe I'll demonstrate this to you. You know, do you remember seeing that Gary Oldman movie, Churchill, that came out a few
years ago? I didn't see it, but I heard about it. I heard about the scene on the tube with the black guy quoting.
That's exactly the scene I'm thinking of, right? Yeah, okay, so I'm going to play this for you here. So I thought back to that movie because we had this controversy over the legacy of Churchill and whether he was the villain of World War II that came up when this guy called Daryl Cooper talked to Tucker Carlson a few months ago. Now, I'm not defending everything that Daryl Cooper's ever said, right?
He was on Millennial.
Oh my God, he was. That's crazy.
Yeah.
He and I have notorious. He is a Christian heretic, and so we've had arguments over that. So I'm not endorsing his entire worldview, right? But I'm sympathetic to this perspective of demythologizing Hitler. Now, demythologizing Churchill. Now, when he demythologized Churchill, all of these guys like Joel Berry and Konstantin Kissin, they lost their ever loving shit. Not over Hitler, not over, you know, some event that Hitler may have perpetrated that I do believe that he murdered millions of people for the people who are listening here. You know, but I'm not going to argue over specifics, but they lost their shit over Churchill. And I always kind of puzzled over that because I'm wondering, like, how did Churchill become such a this figure? And then I remembered back to that very scene, right? So there's this scene where Churchill is going to give his famous, I think it's like a German peace offer, right? So all the troops are stuck in Dunkirk, and he's received a telegram from one of the Nazi party members. There was one of them that was famously a peacenik. I can't remember what his name was. That said, if you respond now, we will cease all hostilities and there'll be peace between Germany and the United Kingdom. You just have to make these territorial concessions in Western France and, of course, Poland. And he's going to Parliament to just reject this offer and to pursue the course of war against Germany unconditionally, right? And he takes the subway, and you said this before, he comes across this woke anachronism. So he starts pulling the people on the subway about what their thoughts were about a new war only, what was it, like 20 years after the end of the other horrific war that Churchill very infamously made more bloody at Gallipoli, right? And so he's pulling these people. And of course, because this is a Hollywood movie, they all rise up and give him these like eloquent speeches about how they'll pay any price for democracy and freedom and this war. You know, which is, I don't know how accurate that would be for your typical London Underground passenger in 1939.
Oh, pay any price for my democracy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But then, what's so delicious about this one scene is they get to an interracial couple in 1939, which would have been so staggeringly rare, right? This would be so rare. I don't, how many Africans were even living and much less, you know, married to white women like that. That would be very, very rare in 1939.
Extremely rare, and they'd be harangued by other people for, you know, for that.
And but the African fellow tells everyone else is like, no, oh, we need to die for freedom and democracy, right? But the African fellow, in a very thick accent, maybe I'm misquoting this, but I remember him reading, and this sounded very, this is a very popular quote. I would actually expect that a very educated person in 1939 might remember this quote. It comes from Thomas Maculay, and it says, "Then spoke the brave Horatius, the captain of the gates, to every man upon the earth. Death cometh to all sooner or later, and how can a man die better than facing fearful odds for the ashes of his fathers and the temples of his gods?" That's the quote that the African fellow gives. I don't think the writers were paying attention, because if they had been, somebody in the audience in 2019 might have asked themselves the same question. Since Churchill, since his actions have persisted, how fair the lands of the ashes of our fathers and the temples of our gods. In fact, whose fathers are we talking about? Whose sons are we talking about? The whole understanding that you hear from Maculay is a supremely collectivist one that relies on a constant notion of our people, of the people, of a particular people that has a particular destiny and a particular land, such that the same earth that the grandson tills, the great-grandfather's ashes or dust is scattered upon. That and to that question, the defenders of Churchill can't really answer. But because if you took Thomas Maculay and brought him to Britain in 2019, he would be utterly aghast at everything that he saw.
If you brought Churchill to, he would be horrified.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, we're all dying for a democracy, but the great irony is that the great wisdom of the ages that's encountered in that scene comes from that scene's largest anachronism. And it's hiding in plain sight the reason why people don't look back on Churchill very fondly, because the result of the regime he handed the world to essentially impoverished the people and made it impossible for them to remember their fathers or their posterity.
Yeah. That's a very good summary. Ever since then, we've been locked into consumerism. We've been atomized. And all of these social forces have taken hold. And now London is majority foreign. Of course, there is more to Churchill than that, because he himself was clearly anti-immigration. And he was a white supremacist. He talked about lower races and so on. It's a bit complicated, but certainly you can say that he destroyed the British Empire and impoverished Britain.
That probably was not his intention.
From it.
It
wasn't his intention. No, but yeah, you go.
No, I don't want to get into the details. It's always impossible. How does he know that he would? We don't honestly know that if we had decided to, negotiate with Hitler, that was his decision, right? In World War II, who do we negotiate with, Hitler or Stalin, right? And it's very possible that in the conflict between, in the Cold War that would have emerged between England and the United States and the Third Reich, a very similar process would have played out where Britain would have lost its colonies, right? So that is very, very possible. So I can't say that, we can't play counterfactuals, right? But the more important thing is that the memory of Churchill should be, was he successful in preserving the English people and or the British peoples? Was he successful at preserving was he successful at preserving their posterity and their faith on the earth? And he made a hard decision, and it didn't work out very well. But the frame has to be on that focus on the religion and the people. And And from that point of view, Churchill just fails. And it's very obvious that this whole thing about this hour of decision and the fight against the Nazis is meaningless, because the framework in which he saw that problem and the framework that we understand that problem are just so incredibly divergent. Nobody in the Second World War wanted to die for some weird concept of democracy. For the most part, they all died for the Queen or for the British people or for the honor of the British people, even though Britain wasn't meaningfully a monarchy anymore.
Yeah, because that was the thing that bound them together.
Yeah.
That was their collective. And so that mattered to them still. And this is the thing, and this actually brings us back to the main topic. There isn't anything like that now, because all of these things have been disallowed and, what's the word, vilified. So nowadays, I don't think you couldn't motivate the public to fight in a world war now, because they've been denied all the things that would motivate them to do so. So this is actually the one of the long-term results of Churchill's decision. And we don't need to keep going on about Churchill. This is the creation of the post-war consensus, the age that we've all grown up in and lived in. It's this deracinated world, and demonstrably it's not sustainable, because, as I just said, people literally wouldn't fight for it. That by definition means that it's unsustainable, even without going into
people don't fight for it, they don't breed for it either.
Well, indeed they don't breed for it. Yeah, exactly. So it's anti-life. I mean, that's actually the situation that we're in now.
Well, this is the problem that we are all dealing with. And the people that can figure out this problem will rule the world. And I think that this is one of the reasons why our task this year and next year is going to be to try to shatter the boomer truth regime or the post-war consensus. Because I think that once we ask these questions and put them to the mainstream, they will start giving us answers that are functionally similar to the ones that you and I have a very different, in some sense, in some ultimate sense, your understanding and my understanding are very, very different, but in a practical sense, not really so much. And the same thing is true for you, I, and Carl Benjamin, that through the process of examining the challenge seriously, we got to a perspective that in its practical broad strokes is more or less moving in the same direction, so to speak. I would offer that to you.
Yes, I agree. I think I'm more sympathetic to paganism than you are. But other than that, I think we are completely agreed. I mean, we obviously need a sane, traditionalist society, a religion that binds people, and a sense of a collective and a sense of a nation. These things need to be realities. Not just, as I was saying about the royal family last night, I mean, it needs to be an actual reality, not just an ornament, a meaningless ornament. These things need to be real. People will fight and die and breed for something that is real, not something that is abstract. And unfortunately, what we've had to deal with for the last 70 years, but definitely the last 20 years in the lifespan of the adulthood of the millennials, is just abstractions. Yeah. I think we're actually now seeing what that results in, which is, as I say, it's antenatal. It's death.
The challenges will be, the first thing is, who can organize sort of core fraternities of highly competent men? This is going to be the first challenge. Then once that happens, I think all the other pieces are going to start falling into place. You will have sort of women glom onto that. There's been problems in the past, whereas, you know, once right-wing women become sort of an autonomous political force, there's this natural conflict that happens over the sex wars. I think we'd seem to step over that. The first step is always to get a group of men who are fraternally bonded to each other and can act as one. And that's why I have been so sort of supportive of these efforts of groups like the Sildings group or Beowulf or the Old Glory Club in the United States, because I see these as sort of primordial. I mean, there's other versions of this. There's tons of people doing this, at least in the US. And if you can get this to work in a way that incorporates the actual elite, the actual men who do the majority of the thing, of the work, then everything else, women will fall into place, the media will fall into place. Once that engine gets moving in a confident single direction, I think everything else will kind of fall into place. I mean, I think that, you know, the main obstacles to that are money, because we don't have it and it's very difficult to get. And I know you talked to Walt Bismarck. It's not surprising that the left gets money and even the sort of like rationalist community gets money. It's because they have got a bunch of single people that just work and give them all their money. or they're allied to the powers that be. They're considered a safe prospect for the powers that be. That they're not going to be too disruptive, so they get that money. And also, very famously, if you're a right winger, usually you have a family, and families mean that it's very difficult to give all of your time or discretional income to these causes. So I think this will be overcome eventually as these groups grow in size, or as new groups come about to replace them and they grow in size. But I'm really looking for that to be the next step.
All right. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. Do you think we've covered the ground sufficiently, or is there more to say?
Yeah, more or less. If there's any questions from the audience, but that's the main thrust of it, I guess.
There are. I'll bring those up now. Yeah, if anyone does have questions, I should say this more often. You can post super chats on Rumble, your Rumble rants. Also, Odyssey's got hyper chats. Also, there's Entropy. Also, there's Ko-fi. Also, there's my own Telegram bot. So there are all sorts of ways to do that. So please do.
Managing social media this year is just a nightmare. the fact that YouTube has kind of died. I don't know if you're not on YouTube anymore, but
no,
you were kicked off of it just at the. I mean, this might be a cold comfort to you, Woz, but you were kicked off of it at the very year where it just died. It's almost not where live streaming is still alive, but like edited videos of the old variety, the algorithm completely, disincentivizes them at this stage.
Yeah, there's a lot to say. I won't go into it. Okay. People are bored hearing me moan about all of this and analyze it. But I was banned in February 21, and thereafter, I think it just became a nightmare.
Oh yeah,
it was already it was a nightmare for the 3 years before that. But I think thereafter, it's like in order to continue on YouTube, you've got to speak in code. I mean, I would find that maddening.
Well, it's not, they don't do, that's not how, no one's getting banned anymore. It's just that everyone's getting deboosted. So it's almost not economical anymore.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, it's nice to have a YouTube channel. And I'm sure in any circumstances, that's the case. But at the same time, practically speaking, you've got to think, how useful is it?
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's public facing and what you're doing is palatable to the people who run YouTube, then you'll be fine. But if it's philosophy or politics, you're just going to get deboosted. So you're not going to be public facing anymore.
Exactly.
That's the thing that YouTube offers. Like with Twitter, the thing that Twitter offers that Gab never could is you can interact with the general public and politicians and journalists and whatever. Great. The thing that YouTube offers that Odyssey never could is that you're talking you're addressing the general public. The general public could easily find your stuff. That's how I ended up with 57K. Great. Well, if you can't do that anymore, if it's not going to do that for you, then what's the point? So you're adhering to all these terrible restrictions and worrying all the time for nothing. So in a way, maybe I'm rationalizing, you know, sort of, it's like a cope where, well,
no, this is the direction everyone's going.
But I think what I'm saying is just echoed by other people that it really is more trouble. Well, not more trouble than it's worth, but it's a bummer to be on YouTube in a way that it definitely wasn't in 2016.
It definitely feels like a dead platform. Most of my audience is there, and my New Year's resolution is to move to move out to these other places where things feel a little bit more alive.
Well, I get for what it's worth, I get the most views on Twitter.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, not Odyssey. Let me see. I'll just for the
I thought maybe Rumble. People want to say anything.
Well, Rumble is big as well, but I think that's more for sort of center-right, alt-light sort of stuff. Let me see how many people. It's 160 are watching on Odyssey. And let me see. On Rumble, it's 165. But on Twitter, it's 1,700. So it's a lot more. Of course, this is, I can't actually remember how many I used to get live viewers on YouTube. I think it was about 2,000, 3,000 for Millennial. Obviously, more people would watch the video afterwards, but this is not a kick in the arse off what I used to get on YouTube. So, you know, it's almost as if, it's almost as if it didn't make any difference, really. Because we're getting the same numbers now on Twitter. That's amazing, really. I mean, I don't think anyone would have predicted this a few years ago. So, yeah, I mean, obviously I would rather have my YouTube channel back, of course. But as I say, it would come with these... I think it's both a plus and a minus, let's put it that way, to be on YouTube now.
Twitter is where the real conversation is happening. I muted myself.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Exactly. Twitter, and I would say Substack as well, but definitely Twitter is the real-time sort of thing.
Yeah, Twitter Substack is a very rarefied audience, but I love it, though. It's great.
Yeah, it's very you, if I may say so. I mean, it seems like it's a platform that sounds like it would suit the distributist.
Oh, it does. It does. The only thing is that I was never really used to writing my ideas. And so writing ideas is different than speaking them, you know, and that's, I'm trying to get over that. But I do, the form of Substack is chef's kiss. The only weird thing is people don't know how to discourse on it, right? So you get people like, you know, people feel like they've just come off of they're back in 2005 and no one's ever disagreed with anyone on the internet on Substack.
Yeah, exactly. There is less discourse on there. I'd like more of that. That's why I always try to encourage people to reply to under my essays, post comments and stuff, because I'm a creature of YouTube in 2015, and that was the whole point. It's like,
yeah,
you do the thing and then you get the feedback and the conversations happen and so on. So yeah, I enjoy that. Okay, so to get to some super chats, Hal 9000 said, Elon Musk's success has been dependent on someone in high places signing it off. 7 out of 8 presidents of the Ivy League universities are Jewish.
I mean, that's true. This is not this is not simply like a JQ question. This is the problem of all oligarchies. Millionaires and billionaires are only rich because they have the cooperation of other millionaires and billionaires. Any millionaire could lose an enormous amount of his wealth if all the others turned against him. That's why, you know, people were wondering, why isn't there a millionaire or a billionaire that will fund the right wing, even though there probably are some that agree with us? Well, the reason is because if the other ones turn against him, he'll lose half of his net worth. And so, you know, there's a natural disincentive there. And I think Elon he's wealthy enough so that he can break with the consensus in part. But yeah, of course he still has to get the approval of other super rich people. Like that's always been the case. It always will be the case. And some of that support's going to have to come from people who are overly interested in the well-being of certain Middle Eastern countries, let's say.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Alt-White said, happy holidays. Thank you very much. Alt-White is extremely generous with Super Chats, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Aristos said, Dave, have you heard of the Collins family recently this year?
Oh, yeah. Well, I did an essay on them.
All right. I'll read this out. The more I engage with them, the more I have a feeling that they are trying to feed right-wing dissent antibodies to make right-wingers submit to woke leftism.
I assume that they're talking about Francis and Simone Collins.
Right.
So Francis and Simone Collins come from my own tribe of Northern California, Bay Area elitists. I wasn't born in the Bay Area, but I just kind of associate with that because that's the people I hung out with. But these are the Silicon Valley types. They're like super pro-natalist, super into eugenics and all this other stuff. They're effective accelerationists. And they have this idea that they're going to invent their own religion to kind of carry forward their genetic and memetic legacy. They're a very strange couple. They're very eccentric. I've received a few emails from them that I'm pretty sure were composed entirely by AI, and it showed. I kind of think that the ideology is a dead end. I think they're sincere. It does feel, if you read or watch the Collins show, it's no secret that they are trying to like optimize on the algorithm. They're trying to min max, and as such, their content always feels super manipulative. But I do genuinely think that Malcolm in particular is a sincere, he believes what he says, but I think he's just autistically fixating on this natalism thing so much that he's kind of lost the forest for the trees. I don't see how anyone is supposed to sign on to the Collins's plan for the future of humanity, since it seems to be built out of like paper and tape and whatever is popular in the YouTube algorithm this last week. There's no feeling of constancy. And my friend who blogs under the name of Black Horse said this. He said, you know, the Collins's plan for natalism is incomplete because in order to be sustainable, you can't just have a family that has a lot of children. You have to have a community that carries forward these ideas and that has a sort of cohesive understanding of itself organically. And the Collins are missing that part of their worldview. And so it feels very artificial. I sympathize with the super chatter thinking that they're trying to be a subversive, but I think they're just being autistic. You know, those two things are frequently confused.
Yeah, I got the person got the name wrong. It's Malcolm and Simone Collins.
Malcolm, yes, that's it.
They are an interesting phenomenon, aren't they?
They're very weird. I mean, this is naturally going to happen. Silicon Valley has become more comfortable with reactionary ideas, and so now you see all sorts of hybrids coming out of this space, and this is one of them. I think that these are not going to be particularly sustainable, though.
Right. Okay. All right. Darby says it's time to step over these silly types that keep pushing this woke right BS. The distributist has been doing such great work. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. I've been kind of not doing much work because I've been sick these last week.
You've been fighting valiantly for the last year. Don't be modest.
Yeah. There's nothing I like more when I'm sick than fighting on Twitter. I don't know why it's so much harder to write an essay than it is to write a really, really long tweet, when hypothetically they're more or less the same thing.
Yeah. I think it's interesting you say that, because I used to have this as well, like with Telegram, where you'd start writing something and it would be one sentence, and then you think, I'll add a couple more. And then before you know it, you've written six paragraphs. And I used to do this, and this is why people said, why don't you start Substack, for God's sake? That this isn't the right platform for six paragraphs, you know? And with Twitter, I don't know, I could get better at Twitter, because there are sometimes I'll read a tweet that I've written after posting it, and I'll think, I could have cut that word out.
Yeah.
That word, that's the, I do it too hastily sometimes.
I've never met anyone better at Twitter than Aaron McIntyre.
Oh, yes, he's very good.
The guy is a prodigy. He's so succinct in his thoughts. He has very similar thoughts to my own, but he says them so, you know, succinctly, right? And
Italian.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, perfect for the limited character format.
Yeah. Okay, but I have to say, your tweets are also very good. I do enjoy reading them.
I enjoy yours as well. It takes all types, right?
Yes, it does indeed. Okay, and then Alt-White also said, you're the best, Woz. Well, thank you very much, Alt-White. I appreciate that. And then Spud Ruckus, this was 8 minutes ago. He asked, do you have an opinion on this attempt at herding the right onto this woke right label by James Lindsay, Kissin, etc.? We've been talking about that throughout the whole stream. I think you must have only just joined.
But here's a question. Like, who's buying this woke right? From everything I can see, it's a total embarrassment. Is anyone actually, is this working?
But I've got to say, I agree with you. I don't think it's working, but do you think there's any real difference? I mean, I think it's pretty much exactly the same as, and I'm not going to have a go at Sargon, right? Everyone knows the history. But he used to call the alt-right right-wing SJWs. Surely, and I know he's changed his tune since then. Fine, right? Let's not have a go at him. There's no need. Surely the woke right thing is just exactly the same.
It is. Well, yeah, but it has. It's going to a boomer audience, right? Sargon's right-wing SJWs didn't work because he was telling it to an audience that asked follow-up questions. But boomers and older Gen Xers don't ask follow-up questions. And that's what led Sargon out of that, is that he started asking himself questions. And, you know, he had to get better answers, right? People don't do a live stream and then change their mind. They do a live stream and then they're left lingering questions, and then they do follow-up research and then slowly change their minds. That's how it works. And, you know, to expect Sargon to do anything differently is just to not kind of, it's kind of, you have to respect how the human mind actually behaves when you do this, right? But, you know, with James Lindsay, a lot of James Lindsay's followers don't ask even basic follow-up questions.
So just to illustrate this, this is the sort of thing that the follow-up questions that end up ruining it all. So just for anyone who's familiar with Jordan Peterson.
I'm not going to read that out loud. No.
It's just quite amusing.
I mean, like
the whole Zionist stuff.
I float this stuff to my, I've in-law. It's sort of funny. I come from a very blue state background, and my wife comes from she's from a different country. She's Canadian, but she comes from a red state background. And I'm amazed how receptive your average boomer red state people are to questions about, well, if we can be collectivist for Zion, why can't we be collectivist for our own people? And who are our own people? I said that at a dinner party, and I expected to get, I expect my wife to hit me on the head and say, stop ruining things. But like, it was very well received. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Well, if they have a sacred status as a group, then why don't we? And unless you believe it's something about God's chosen people or whatever, but, you know,
no,
I don't. And,
I don't think that's what it really is. What it is, is they think that first they'll get it and then we'll get it as like an inheritance. So first we have to once Israel is established, then everyone will realize that they need their own homeland. And this will be kind of like the first step. I mean, that's what they kind of believe, and they just don't ask follow-up questions, right?
Well, obvious follow-up question to that is, if this is going to be our homeland eventually, then why are we now filling it up with foreigners?
Yeah.
That's just retarded. Exactly.
And then there's a secondary question about, well, they'll go like illegal immigrants, and then you have to, well, it's not just illegal immigrants, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. And the problem isn't that they don't speak English. That's not the real problem, right? The real problem is that they contest collectively for political power and territorial concessions at the highest level. Mm-hmm. And when that's going on, your ability to assert control and to organize young people is limited necessarily.
I mean, you can look at this in very materialistic terms. Gene pools compete. And that is why different, I've forgotten what the collective, is it Herd of Wolves? Packs of Wolves. Mm-hmm. This is why packs of wolves have their own territories. Because if they didn't, they'd be killing each other all the time. Because gene pools compete, even within the same species like that. So obviously, you can say that man is more than an animal and he's above these things, but he's not above these things. That's it at a materialistic, purely material level. There's more to it than that, but well, as I say, you've even got to deal with this. You've even got to deal with this base animal nature before you get into ideals and principles and whatever.
Well, I mean, and then you can see this, like, you can directly do this because it's linked, the quantity that links these things is the housing price. So Steve Saylor, not to cite him again, but he's pretty definitively shown through reams and reams of research that housing price is the one thing. High housing price depresses native birth rates. High immigration leads to high housing price, depressing native birth rates.
Depressing. Like diversity itself depresses birth rate.
Yeah, I've heard. Has Ed Dutton done stuff on that? I'm not convinced of that yet. But definitely the housing prices does, right? So
yeah,
but, you know, well, I always like to do it.
Instability leads to lower birth rates because white people are sensitive to this stuff. Well, they're not going to bring kids into an unstable world.
All civilized people hate instability, and it causes them to essentially kill themselves in various ways.
Yeah,
it's a very, very dangerous thing. This thing called chaos, and human beings deal with it to their ultimate detriment. But you know, I don't like speaking in materialist terms. But yeah, there is the dimension to that can't be ignored. And that's another thing too. Like, there's this whole Christian question too, where a lot of the Christian actors that they'll kind of like scoff at you for pointing out material reality, even if it's a material reality that the Bible itself acknowledges. And so you get into these sort of ridiculous conversations these conversations that are going on in the American right between Christians are, in my mind, kind of insane. And I hope we can just get through them as fast as possible because they're ridiculous.
I interrupted you 5 minutes ago when you were talking about James Lindsay and the woke right. Was there something else that you wanted to say about that?
Other than I can't believe anyone buys this, and I don't think anyone else is buying this. The only thing is, I think I think James Lindsay, I literally don't know who watches him. He's like one of these people like Richard Hanania. I don't know who Richard Hanania's audience is. I know who Richard Hanania's funders are. I know who James Lindsay's funders are. But I don't know who his audience is. Most of the people who like James Lindsay liked him from the before times when he was just kind of a garden variety anti-SJW person.
Right. Okay. And let's see if there are any. Oh, yes, there are quite a few. Aristocratic Owl said, I like that name, by the way. He said, Merry Christmas, Dave. Coming from a friend, I hope your family is enjoying the holiday season in good health. Hope the children are treating you guys well.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I think I know that person in real life, but it's hard with all of the people I've met this last year to keep the names and the faces. And I should have ideally you'd have like a little flow chart, but that would be risky for people's online identity. So you just have to kind of try to remember. But you know how what happens is like you just go way past Denbar's number and you can't. It's very difficult to match the faces to the Twitter handles.
Yes. Oh, tell me about it. I mean, I try, but I always feel so rude when I don't remember somebody.
It's really hard, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. So it's a good problem to have. I shouldn't complain. All right. Trev said, I always look forward to Millennial. Thanks for your work. Well, thank you very much, Trev. And then Aristocratic Owl said, wait, did Tinder really come after Grindr? I did not know this, which honestly makes Tinder even more of a problem. Yes, it did. I checked while we were doing this, and Grindr was in 2009, and Tinder was 2012.
So yeah, I remember a pretty distinctly saying that it was inspired by Grindr, and it's really bad when you think about it because it's just the most poisonous way for men and women to interact.
It is, and it's leading women down into a very unhealthy. I mean, men are built for. I mean, we like variety, and that's just a part of male sexuality. But inveigle women, and I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying it's there. It's been a problem forever. You know, infidelity and so on, and the 7-year itch and all of this. But it's. It's something that is naturally there and needs to be brought under control. With women, to inveigle them down that road and say, hey, be like this, is a terrible... Because what that results in is they don't actually have sex. I mean, I know that there are women who have sex with like 100 guys by the time she's 20 and all this. But what most women just do is get lost in this endless river of indecision. Where yeah. every guy has to compete with every other guy that she's already swiped past. And, the result is she ends up a childless cat lady at 30, at 40. I mean, that's a disaster.
It's amazing. It's so obvious to see that. And, I mean, it's like OnlyFans, too. It's like you'd have to be insane to think that this was a good thing to unleash on society. Or Pornhub. There was this, you know... I'm not going to comment.
Just dreadful.
Yeah, there's this. The owner of Pornhub was it Joe Rogan, and he speaks like this horrible Silicon Valley like number cruncher. Like he has no concept of the human, like or the spiritual. He's like, well, there is an opportunity to arbitrage this this market of centralizing all porn consumption, and we just went in there and we leveraged that opportunity to maximize our key metrics. I'm like, good Lord, what a reptile! I mean, this is a poisonous thing for young men in particular, and now we've hidden this poison behind numbers and spreadsheets and interest equations.
Yes, it's not what one expects of a rabbi, is it?
I have a particular hatred in my heart for people who pose as religious and do evil through that. And yeah, that kind of brought him to the top of my I can't comment here on your channel. Let's move on.
Okay. All right. Flare Cake said, hey, Dave, longtime fan here ever since the Pulp Fiction video. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Yeah, that's a very old one. That's like when my first videos I really poured my heart and soul into. And I wish I could find, are your videos are still archived on, are they archived on BitChute or?
Yeah, there are some, a lot of them are on BitChute, but they seem to be not playable now. There are some on Alt Censored. There are some on my Odyssey channel. I mean, some of them I took down because I, you know, once you get doxxed, there are things that it could just be dodgy for various reasons.
Yeah, of course.
Because people I've known in my real life might see something where I've mentioned them and this kind of thing. They're here and there. I mean, if somebody really wants a particular video, then contact me and I'll see if I can send it to you. There we go. All right. But what was the Pulp Fiction video? I don't remember a Pulp Fiction video.
Oh, I did this video about Pulp Fiction, like really early, way before I started commenting on the political scene in 2016. I did a video about Pulp Fiction, comparing it to the sort of platonic forms of love, like Eros, Storge, Philia, Agape, right? And each skit in Pulp Fiction is about how a lower love is defeated by a higher form of human understanding.
I think I do remember that now. Very, very good. Very interesting. All right. And then, there was one. Yeah, okay. So, Black Pigeon Pilled. Does the distributist endorse the social credit of C.H. Douglas? I'm aware of G.K. Chesterton taking an interest in this, along with distributism, after the economic turbulence of 1929, which, as Godfrey Bloom said, we may be at risk of repeating again. Social credit of C.H. Douglas.
I know he wrote The Monopoly of Credit, but I have not read his books. I have not read C.H. Douglas. Major Clifford Hugh Douglas. I'm just at a complete loss. I'm familiar with Hilaire Belloc and G.K. Chesterton. And other authors who were interested in sort of third way economic systems, after which I named my channel one. I am not aware of his particular work, so I'll have to read up on that. I think that, you know, this one thing I'm a big fan of is we need to get rid of this whole capitalism versus socialism thing. It's totally meaningless. It's totally meaningless. It's not what's relevant anymore. And you can see leftists, they're just praying. They're just praying that they can become relevant again by having a big fight about capitalism. We just can't have that conversation. It is not relevant in a world where all the money is fake and printed.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It's very interesting. It's like it opens up a whole field there for discussion.
Yeah.
Okay, Stephen says, good point from Dave about Twitter versus Substack. That's basically what I meant yesterday. We need public platforms, though I wish Substack had more reach, since it's a better platform for long-form stuff, and so better for our intellectuals. I think that's what pretty much what you said, isn't it?
Substack is sort of for elite posters. Twitter is for plebeians. I guess
you and I dabble.
Yeah, exactly. I don't mean that. Maybe we should rename Orrin McIntyre the Tribune of the Plebs, Substack is great because you can. I'm hoping at some point to write essays that will build up to like a larger publishable thing. That's I'm trying to plan that out. But I think that's what people are going to use it for. They're going to create plans for posts that then become like pamphlets or books that can be sent to one of these publishing houses and then become a centerpiece for conversation permanently. They kind of set their ideas in stone. And because Substack is already kind of more in stone than Twitter. Like I write something on Substack because I want people to be able to reference it and be able to cite it in the future. And text is very good for that. So I think that's kind of the role it's going to play.
Yeah.
What I want to know is how long, I think Blue Sky is going to collapse. You can tell the mainstream really wants Blue Sky to work. Now the question is the mainstream media powerful enough to make Blue Sky work? My money is on no, but I'm not super certain about that. That'll be an interesting thing to see in the next few months.
Well, as I've said before, it's like Gab. We tried to have our own platform, and it's there, and props to Andrew Torba, but it's not a substitute for. I mean, it's a substitute for Twitter. It's not a replacement for Twitter, and yeah. I think the libs will find exactly the same thing with Blue Sky. It'll be fine. It'll be a redoubt for them, safe space, but it'll be fucking boring.
Yeah, and that's something that is. Something that you the celebrities think that they have enough draw to make it a thing, but I don't think that will ultimately work.
Yeah, I agree. All right, an aristocratic owl said, Dave, you better read us either a Christmas poem or a poem sent around Advent at the end of the stream, off on a good and jolly note for the season. Hate for you to break off from your wholesome presence.
I wonder if Yeats has a Christmas poem. He does. Here's a simple one. My favorite poet is, people might know this about me, my favorite poet is William Butler Yeats. An Irish Protestant, no less. This is very short, so you'll appreciate this. The Magi. Now, as at all times, I can see in the mind's eye, in their stiff painted clothes, the pale, satisfied ones appear and disappear in the blue depths of sky, with all their ancient faces like rain-beaten stones, and all their helms of silver hovering side by side, and all their eyes still fixed, hoping to find once more, being by cavalry's turbulence unsatisfied, the uncontrollable mystery on the bestial floor. Very, I always consider that a companion piece to his most infamous poem, The Second Coming. But it's mercifully short for the purposes of the stream. So, 1914 it was written.
When was The Second Coming written?
That's a good question, actually. I thought it was written after.
I'll find out. It was 1919.
Ooh, right after World War One. That's interesting because he compares the infant Christ to like a beast in this, in the fact that, you know, the Godhead appears in something that is a newborn infant, which is so primally animalistic. And then he also sort of compares like the Antichrist to, you know, or maybe, I don't know, maybe Christ again, or maybe the Antichrist. It's hard to say that you see in the second coming. It's very, a very constant theme he has going through his poetry.
Hmm. It's a wonderful image, shuffling towards Bethlehem to be born.
Yeah.
Scary. all right. Well, let's, on that happy note, let's end this one here.
All right.
I don't think there are any other super chats, but thank you to everyone who did post some in. Dave, this has been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed it, and I think it's been very interesting.
Thank you very much for having me again, Wes.
Okay. Is there anything you'd like to say about these topics before we end?
No, I guess we'll just see what happens, and hopefully God will be with us in this year, because I think it's going to be quite turbulent.
Oh, I would say so. I would say so. all right. Well, tomorrow night it's going to be another four streams, and that will be the penultimate night of four streams. Night Nation Review, and then Endeavor, and then JF, and then Semiogog, finally. Mm. I'll try not to mess up Semiogog's stream like I did last year by being too lax early on with him, and he went off about, I think, British biscuits or British sitcoms or something. And that really spoiled it. It was my fault. I don't blame him at all. It really sort of took the whole thing off on the wrong footing. And then we couldn't get it back. But anyway, it doesn't really matter. Nobody really cared. I think people enjoyed it.
It's nice to have the ones that are odd, right?
Yes, that's true. All right, well, I will be back tomorrow night with those. But in the meantime, the distributist, based Dave, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Get the info you need at millennial.com/crypto and make your donation today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.